Hi, this is Helen.
And this is Jessie.
And you're listening to Asian Bitches Down Under. And this is our final episode of the year 2023. It is, what's the date today? 22nd of December. I think either today or yesterday was the winter
solstice?
Solstice of the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah.
What is that?
I think it's
for those who live
colder
in the south.
Day of the year up.
Okay.
The north, like we have in the southern hemisphere, which is somewhere around July or August.
Right.
Yeah, because I just look at my Facebook memories this morning, and last year today or yesterday that we were having the Tangyuan, which is not solstice for us, but I have this, you know, like kind of like a rituals that I just have it. Because it's the coldest year, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere when we were growing up. Yeah, so
yeah.
I'm
gonna
get some tang yuan, the rice balls.
Even though it's like blazing hot outside.
Yeah, even though it's blazing hot outside, yes.
And there are bushfires in WA.
To keep in the traditionals. Yeah, okay. What would you like to start today?
Well, I guess what I've been really kind of eager to talk about is thing I've seen this year, because this year will, this is, episode will be a wrap about stuff we've seen and heard and read this year, sort of our favorites. I was just telling Helen before we started recording that I still haven't, unfortunately this year there hasn't been a book that shook me and made me fall in love with it so deeply in the way that Gabrielle Zevin's Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow did. Last year or the year before. I came out maybe 12 to 18 months ago. So that's been kind of depressing. I kind of I'm so like starved of narratives that make me just grip me so hard and stay with me for a long time. And I think it's because I haven't been as proactive as I used to be in going out and searching for books that speak to me. So this is one of my goals for 2024, is to dedicate more intentional time to reading books that perhaps, you know, align with my interests more deliberately. I think I'd like to do that. And we were talking before about the way in which we chart our consumption. So Helen has a list that she makes of the, all the books that she reads in her diary, whereas I don't. And every year, at the beginning of every year, I have like a notebook lying around and I think, okay, this is the one where I'm going to write down all the books that I've read. But my issue is that I often don't finish books because life is too short. I've never felt the need to finish something that I don't enjoy 100%. And so I guess that complicates things, because then I forget about the list, or like I don't know what the benchmark is for a book making it onto the list. You know, if I've read 280 out of the 300 pages, does that qualify for the list? So anyway, long story short, I actually do make a list of all the movies I make, I read. At least I'm more intentional about writing it. And it could be because writing about it, but it could be because I'm actually writing a book right now about filmmakers, about female filmmakers, and I always try and write notes about every movie, most movies I'd say, that I watch. And the thing I wanted to talk about this in this segment, and just kick things off, is the sort of trend of male biopics that we have seen this year, and the way in which the story of their wives are often kind of very unsubtly slid into the narrative. And so, for instance, if we start off by talking about Oppenheimer, which came out in July, there was quite a big chunk of the narrative that focused on Emily Blunt's character, the wife, and also the mistress played by Florence Pugh. Did you see that movie?
No, I know the movie you're going to mention in the next 5 minutes, and I don't think I've seen any of them. Oppenheimer.
Okay, yeah. So the other movies I was going to mention are Napoleon.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Yep,
I guess the last one.
Oh, there's actually two more.
Oh, okay. Can I guess one of them then?
Yeah, of course.
Talk about Bernstein. Is that Maestro?
Yeah, that's right. Perfect, Helen. And then finally, Ferrari, which is starring Adam Driver.
Oh, okay. I don't know about that one. Okay.
Okay, well, so that's coming out in January in
Oh, okay.
Australia. So that's probably, yeah, the posters are coming out now. And all of the issue I have with these movies is that often their wives are played by A-list actors. Like, so for instance, you've got Emily Blunt and Florence Pugh playing sidelined wives in Chris Nolan's movie. In Napoleon, you have N Vanessa Kirby, probably less of a well-known star, but still like tremendously acclaimed. Maestro, you have Carey Mulligan, of course. And do you want to guess who Ferrari's wife is
Oh,
played
I'm
by?
familiar with that film, so I don't know anything about it. I know, is she? I'm assuming that must be a Caucasian. Is someone that I
Italian.
Oh, I don't know any Italian
Well,
actor.
this actor is actually not Italian, but she's in the role anyway. It's
Oh,
Penelope Cruz.
what? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, Penelope Cruz with Adam Driver. Okay, that sounds
I
a bit
know. It's just like it's like the world, like the greatest actress in our generation with like a toy boy. Sorry, I shouldn't say Adam Driver's a toy boy. I mean, he's obviously can act, but his shtick of masculinity is like, I don't know. I kind of shrug it off. He's a very serious actor. So I think what I have an issue with in all these biopics is the sense that these narratives focus, I mean, they're all, let's not kid ourselves, they're all about the men because number one, look at the title. Like every single title, Oppenheimer, no, not Napoleon, Maestro, Ferrari, refer to the singular man, right? Let's not pretend it's anything else. The posters are often of just the guy itself, himself, right? But the way in which these films have been sort of both marketed, talked about, and also the content within the film, it seems to want us to believe that the story is often about
The
the
greatness.
marriage,
Oh, the
the
marriage.
ma yeah yeah like the marriage of the guy.
Me say
And
that the
also,
greatness of their career or something like
oh
that.
no, it's so I think maybe 30 years ago these biopics would have maybe just focused on the man and their career, but it seems that these days, for whatever reason, men have started to make films biopics about these other great men that they look up to. And sort of wanted to feel like they've wanted to add in the element of the wife, as if it was the only way in which we could humanize these men, or sort of like remind us that there was always a suffering wife in the sidelines, as though the suffering wives were really the sort of the key reason, or like they were so vital to the sort of not just the success of the men, but also the humanity of these men that, we've all studied these men in high school, but like these stories, I think they're trying to sort of carve out the humanity or like the personable side of these men. So for instance, in Maestro, there's quite a lot of scenes where we see Leonard Bernstein interact with his three children. And we have a lot of these scenes where they're framed in a way that show him as the family man. And anyone who's ever read half a Wikipedia entry on Bernstein, or has ever known him or like studied him or anything, know that he was very unapologetically promiscuous. He was completely dedicated to his artwork, to his art. He was never around. His family were kind of like on the side. It was very peripheral. And it's almost like the only way we can engage with these men, these historical figures these days, is through the lens of them being like the family man, or like the head of the family. And I just have a weird issue with that.
I think I'm on the same boat with you about the idea that these movies trying to humanize these male historical figures by putting them as a family man, even though that we know that they might have, they have done, you know, things atrociously inhumane, or I don't know, you know, maybe just, you know, not, you can't really justify it. But these movies have trying to beautify them in a way to make them more human, but at the same time,
exactly,
deny what they have done. That is very harsh to perhaps the people that love them or they loved. And I really hate the way that, I don't know if it's in English that they have a similar phrase. When I was growing up, I used to hear that this phrase in Chinese, 成功的男人背后都有一个 something 女人, like,
yeah,
men always have a dedicated or supportive woman behind him, but
yeah,
always is, he always places that the woman as a supplementary property, not even a, not even humanizing the woman to build up this successful male character, but we never remember the name of the woman. Do we,
exactly,
you know, we know Josephine, but that's it, you know, do we actually remember the names of the woman that Oppenheimer has interacted with? No, we don't, you know. Does history remember Bernstein's wife or whoever that he slept around with? You know, no, we don't. So at the end of the day, the history is being told by the people who hold authority and power to, I can't try to find a word, to kind of remember the one that they think is the greatest. At the end of the day, again, it's the man who dominates the space of history. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that what I've seen that's so interesting is, you know, like, these are obviously, these four male characters are obviously, you know, among history's most significant and sort of ubiquitous, in a sense, men, you know, like, Leonard Bernstein is probably sort of in the last 100 years the most important anywhere, not just American, important conductor or important influencer of classical music. I guess the same with Ferrari, you know, he changed the landscape of cars and F1. Napoleon, obviously we all know, like, no, who doesn't know Napoleon? Like, your daughter is 10 years old. Do you think she knows who Napoleon is? Do you think they've covered that character in school?
I have to ask her. Yeah,
he's just, yeah,
but she did know, and then, she did know about Josephine. Remember that we were talking about Napoleon during one of our outings, and she goes, oh, is that the one, is that the guy,
short French dude?
Short French dude. She said short French dude.
I think, yeah, I think that's how I came across,
yeah,
first time when I heard about Napoleon. What made him, what was, like, what was the most sort of his tidbit was that the fact that he was short.
Oh. But then we looked up, he's 168.
I know, he's not, actually exactly short at all.
No, it's 168.
Funny, it's very funny. Yeah, but I think what I find interesting is that, you mean, all these directors that we've talked about, Chris Nolan, Ridley Scott, Michael Mann, they're, like, you know, the most important directors of our generation in the last 50, 60 years. Bradley Cooper is more of a newcomer, but he's obviously trying to set himself the goal of being, mm-hmm, like a serious male director. Mm-hmm. And by tackling, you know, classical music's most important figure in the last 100 years, obviously, you know, these men, I think watching Bradley Cooper act as Leonard Bernstein, it really just made me think, at the end of the day, Bradley Cooper just wanted to be Leonard Bernstein. Like, it, like, okay. I listened to this video on YouTube where a woman just says that he is basically getting off by trying to imitate Leonard Bernstein. Mm-hmm. And it's a vanity project, she said, which I kind of completely agree with, because you see the way in which he appears on the screen and the way he's trying to mimic the way in which Leonard Bernstein spoke, it's kind of very clearly just like Bradley Cooper wanting to be Leonard Bernstein. So, and it made me think about, like, the way in which it made me think about sort of universally the way in which I think what differs, what the life of a man compared to the life of a woman, this is where it really differs. It's the sense that there are possibilities for you. So if you grow up as a white man, there are like infinite numbers of white men in history who you can look up to. So if you're a scientist, there's like so many male scientists you can look up to. If you're a musician, so many male musician conductors that who look like you, you can look up to. Absolutely. Any kind of industry that you want to do as a white man, there are like infinite, or even just any colored man, there are so many different types of people who have already done what you perhaps want to do that you can, you know, aspire to. It's like you have a limitless number of pathways, right? But like me as a woman, I just thought to myself, hell, I was like, okay, I'm a woman. Let's just even forget the fact that I'm Asian for the moment. Like, and I thought if I was a director and there's a vanity project that I want to make, you know, there's like a woman in history that I want to play, like the equivalent of Bradley Cooper wanting to be Leonard Bernstein, right? I was like, who is a woman in history who I would love to be? And I'm like, even right now, I'm like, I can't think of a single woman in history who I would love to be. You know what I mean? There's like, there's not been a woman who I'm like, that's like an amazing thing that she did. She changed everything. I would love to play her. Maybe like the closest I can think of is maybe like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like she really, truly. So like, you know, Felicity, whatever that woman's name is, I forget her name, but she played RBG the right to sex or something, or I forget that name, where Armie Hammer was the husband. Yeah, so I think that would be pretty incredible to play like a, but even that, it's like she was a judge, she was a lawmaker, like how sexy can that be, you know? Whereas like Bradley Cooper, he grew up and he wanted to be a conductor, he became an actor, and now he can actually like physically and also just in every way embody and pretend to be the person he wanted to be when he grew up. And like for me, there's like nobody I can think of throughout history, women who have done something that I've like think, oh, I would love to play them
at the equal level as Bernstein, Napoleon, or
exactly. Yeah, like can you, oh, maybe Hillary Clinton, if there was a movie about Hillary Clinton, maybe I would like to play her.
Yeah, I guess, but it's sad to think of, even if it's for female, that we can try to come up with a white female, white woman, but can you think of an Asian? Not even talking about Chinese, not about Asian historical figure that is at the similar level of Napoleon, Oppenheimer.
No. It's not, you know? Because women didn't create history.
Yeah, I mean, we can, you know? But then again, if we did, the thing is that the history records don't prolong that kind of discussions for those female historical,
exactly,
you know, figures. I mean, my daughter's reading Rebel Girls, you know, there's a lot of female historical figures that I just learned when I'm in my 30s, I never heard before. And just right now we're having this discussion, the two female Asian or maybe Chinese historical figures that I can think of, one is probably more of a fictional, you know, Mulan, because we know through Disney, but even Mulan, and the other one is Wu Zetian, which is like the Chinese empress, I think early Qing dynasty, that she was empire back then. But even then, she had a lot of negative stories.
Yeah,
all through dramas, you know, in the 80s, 90s. So I can't really think of right now immediately of a Asian.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my gosh, that's really sad. Yeah, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. And like, I guess the most famous Asian I can think of off the top of my head is the actress from Hollywood, May, what was her name again?
May Wong, is it Wong?
May Wong, yeah, that's it. Yeah, the silent film actress. Yeah, yeah. So she, and then she, you know, she had a shit life.
Yeah,
she wasn't able to be cast in anything or taken seriously in Hollywood because of her Asian face. But I think what the antidote to all of this is, like, movies like Hidden Figures, you know, movies like that that focus on the people who have forgot, who have been forgotten in history. Like, yes, that was about three African-American women, but it still managed to make a biopic about women who, you know, we wouldn't have known about at all. Like, if that movie wasn't made, I would never have heard about those Katherine Johnson, you know, for instance.
So we wouldn't know about them in our school textbooks, you know.
Exactly.
Our history textbooks would not teach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The sadness of the reality.
Yeah, and also I think because feminism is still so nascent, like it's very new. I mean, you know, when you measure the length of civilization, feminism is still very new. And so if anyone was going to make a movie about any woman in history, 99.9% of it, the women that you're going to draw from are going to be women who have been disenfranchised, marginalized, neglected, abused, like, because, you know, literally up until 100 years ago, I mean, even now, you know, let's not kid ourselves, women's stories are not, women's lives are not as enriching and as expansive as men's. Yeah. And, like, it goes back to my point before, which is that, you know, if you're a man growing up in this world, you have so many different men who have done so many incredible things to have made the world the way that it has, that you have role models, you have people who you can aspire to be. And like for women, there's like, who can I aspire to be? Or I'll just play the suffering wife, or like Marie Antoinette, who had her head chopped off when she was 35 or whatever. I don't think she was 35, but you know, it's just like the only examples we have of any kind of significant women who have been remembered in history are women who have died prematurely, suffered at the hands of men, and
had a shitty life.
That's like, yeah, exactly. And so, like, why would I want to watch a movie about that?
Why would
I want to play a woman who doesn't have joy in her life, or not just joy, but like doesn't get to,
what kind of aspirations get, that young girls can
exactly
look at, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, like, doesn't have the capacity or the means to go off and do what she wants to do, you know.
Yeah, when you were mentioning, you just mentioned Marie Antoinette, it reminded me, Catherine Chan's book that I read last year, Joan of Arc.
Oh yeah,
it's like a, it's a biography, but written in a fictional way where there is a lot of reimagined narratives throughout the book. It was one of the most memorable book that I read last year. But it also, like you said, you know, even Joan of Arc is something that I'd like to see to be made into a very epic movie. I know that there has been movies and dramas being,
you know, Lily Sobieski,
yeah, of Joan of Arc, but I really want to see something that is more positive. But then again, you can't really go against what had happened in
exactly history. We can't whitewash history.
Yeah, she had died very young.
Oh my god,
life again, you know?
Exactly, that's probably why people don't make movies about women, because it's just too depressing.
It's too depressing, and it's not something that you want to aspire, it's not something that you can aspire to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you know what? I had, I work, like, at the moment I'm writing the script for the pilot of my first book, and I'm working with this amazing screenwriter, movie guy who's been in the industry for decades. And he said something to me that, sort of a few times while we were in the writer's room, which I always remember, which I always keep with me, which is that he said, at the end of the day, remember that your main character, your audiences want to be him. Or her. You got to write a character where your viewers want to be that person.
Yeah.
And so like that's probably why we don't write, like, not just that we don't have a lot of women protagonists, but because we can't, because the reality is that women throughout history have led lives that have been full of suffering. And why would you want to, like, you wouldn't make a movie where the protagonist is like just a suffering woman, because who wants to be that, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes me think, like, all these male, like, coming back to Oppenheimer, Napoleon, Maestro, Ferrari, like, in a way, it's like, great, we're like sort of allowing the story of the wives to come into these narratives, right? But at the end of the day, like, even me as a woman, and not just a white woman, but an Asian woman, even me watching Oppenheimer, Napoleon, Maestro, I haven't seen Ferrari, but I will, even sitting through those films, at the end of the day, I don't want to be their wives. I want to be Napoleon. I want to be Oppenheimer. I want to be the one who's creating things that help change the world. You know, I want to be the one at the front of the podium in front of an orchestra of 150 musicians. I don't want to be on the sideline like Carey Mulligan is. I don't want to be the woman, like the wife standing on the side of the stage, like clapping and like admiring my husband. Like, I want to be the goddamn fucking conductor, you know?
But then you'll be talking about Kate Blanchett's character, Tar.
Yeah, but she's like not real.
She's not real, but it's trying to create a character. But then again, when you're trying to create a powerful female character,
she's always fucked up.
Yeah, she's always been fucked up.
She's awful.
Character, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not the character that you want young girls to become.
Yeah, I know. And like, it made me kind of, in a sort of weird way, I was actually really angry by the fact that Tar was made, and that Cate Blanchett, like the conductor, the main character of the story, was a woman, because like 5% of conductors are women.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they've made the most famous fictional like movie of the last 50 years about a conductor, right? Like, why couldn't they have just made it with a male protagonist? And because, like, all throughout history, the majority has been male conductors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to make a movie that doesn't actually celebrate the conductor, because no, Lydia Tarr, the character, is vile, you know, and she's painted as such an awful human. And the fact that they had to choose a woman to play that role, when reality is that most male conductors,
those kind of things.
Most conductors are male, and also the sort of awful behaviors that Lydia Tarr is made to do in the movie, it's the men who have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to tell the story through the female lens just really kind of pissed me off, because it's such a misrepresentation of what actually happens, which is that men and also male conductors do what she does.
Yeah, I know. And I also hated that, because she's in the movie, she's a lesbian character, and you paint a really, really horrible picture, I think.
Of lesbians, yeah.
Of lesbians. Yep. And I really hate that.
It's,
like you say, it's a really poorly represented sort of a narrative for all the bad things that male conductors did. And they have to choose a female lesbian character to play this.
I know, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I hate that. When actually in real life, it's like 99% of predators are straight men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know where to leave from that, but should we just take a quick break?
Okay.
We'll talk about a couple of cultural consumptions that we've consumed the last couple of weeks. And here you go. We'll be right back. Hi there. If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify, and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry. Okay, so we're back. I want to start off to talk about one of the audiobooks that I listened to maybe a couple of weeks ago. I finished it within a week. So I've got the recommendation from Kevin Chen, one of my favorite Taiwanese authors, to read Stay True by Hua Xu, the Taiwanese American or Asian American writer who supposedly, I think he works for New York Times or New Yorker. I got the audiobook in, I think, the end of November.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it's actually read by Hua Xu himself. It has a similar tone of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, even though that it's like a memoir. Mm-hmm. I would divide the book into like three parts. The first part is him talking about him growing up as a Taiwanese American. He gives me the sense that he came from a very well-off family because his academics. I'm not saying that all academics are very well-off, but they had this. They were smart enough to study in the U.S. And when
I think when I hear an educated parents, like any kind of university affiliated parents, I'm like wealth.
Yeah, wealth, because you need wealth to get
educated. Yeah.
And there's a large portion of him talking about music, bands, pop culture, his memories with his dad who used fax machine to communicate with him because his dad returned to Taiwan when he was in like high school age to work in Taiwan. And that part felt a little bit unreal for me because I couldn't really feel resonated to it because he wrote a huge part about how he connected with his dad, how they talk about their feelings, how they talk about ball games. I feel really conflicted during this when I was listening to this part because it's such a rare version of Asian fathers who, you know, communicate so directly with their kids. But again, it's very, you know, I feel like I vicariously had that kind of feeling that, oh, maybe this is the alternative parenting that I could have had, but I didn't. And they share a lot about their lives. The dad even helped him with his homework, you know, having fax machine, because back then there wasn't internet yet, and fax machine was probably the best and the fastest way to communicate a really lengthy conversation without paying a huge phone bill, because phone, you know, international calls were expensive too.
Bring back the fax machine.
Yeah. Hua Xu also talked about a lot about fashion of that time, cultural influences and movies. So that was the first part. And the second part and the final part is about, spoiler alert, next 2 minutes, if you don't want to be spoiled, you know, skip this part. He talked about the tragedy of one of his good friend who died from a robbery gun shooting incident. And the final part is more of him that he writes about like the healing path of him. And he wrote about the relationship with his college friend Ken, which is the one who passed away. They were not connected initially, but he took the liking of this guy because he was popular, he was very approachable, he welcomed everyone. Reminded me of Marx from Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And also because he's a Japanese American as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a larger portion of his writing is almost like a healing path for him. And like he felt guilty, this exploration of grief and self-questioning, like what could I have done if, you know, if I didn't just leave that night, you know, he will be still alive today. I read the review. I don't know if I like this book or not. I know that the writing style is, he articulates really well, and some parts feel really lyrical and poetic, but I just found it hard to engage into the pain that he's trying to express. There's a lot of bittersweetness. Feels more like a memoir that he's trying to dedicate to his friend. But then again, reading through the comments on Goodreads, a lot of people who only gave 2 or 3 stars mentioned that he's kind of like self-absorbed. He writes about
I love that. I love bad Goodreads reviews.
He writes about his journalistic trajectories. He says
Right.
that, oh, I'm writing my zine, like his
Yeah.
magazines, It's, I feel like maybe that's a little bit too much. That's why that some readers even say that it's insufferable, his pretentious.
You know what? Yeah, so I have a few points to say to this, to your marvelous review. I have been super reluctant to read this, despite Hua Su being a huge figure in the New Yorker kind of presence, right? Because he's been writing for the New Yorker for ages. He's one of only a few POCs. He's one of even fewer Asian writers, right? There's like the Chinese writer who's Yan Qing something, who writes more exclusively about Chinese stuff. And then there's Gia Tolentino, obviously, and then there's Hua Su. And Hua Su's essays I've never really gelled with in the way that I've gelled with Gia Tolentino's, because yeah, I find that his writing is way more kind of elliptical. I feel like Gia Tolentino writes for my generation, and also she writes from a deep place of being a woman. Hua Su, I feel a bit bad in not having thrown my support behind him 100% because he's Taiwanese and I want to support Taiwanese people and I want to be able to relate to Taiwanese people. But I've been so reluctant to pick up this book, which has been everywhere, by the way, in the last 18 months. I feel like a lot of white people love his writing.
And I
It's
can
a
understand
really
why, because it's really, I know that we overuse this word, but I feel like it's really New York whitishness.
I mean, he is a very educated person. He basically went through all the channels of like elite, elite coastal Ivy League schools. I think he went to Princeton or something, or Stanford,
He went to
right? These people are of a certain milieu. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, he works for the goddamn New Yorker.
No times.
Everyone there went to an Ivy League, And the re other reason why I've really not decided to pick up this book yet is because, yeah, I know what the content is about. I know it's about grief. And it's just like, I'm rolling my eyes right now. Like, nothing against grief. Obviously, it's important to write about these issues, but like, I just like, I'm so tired of grief-filled stories. Like, I'm just like, just give me something, anything that's like joyful or funny. I think grief has become this kind of go-to content generator where like it's almost like you market anything and say, oh, this book is about grief, and people will buy it. It's almost like it's like catnip for people these days. This whole trope of grief, and I'm just like, oh, I don't want to learn about it. It's just so depressing. Maybe I just like, when I open a book, I don't want to feel sad anymore, And I feel like the last book that I read that made me decide I've had enough of this is Crying in H Mart, obviously, one of the saddest books ever. And after that, I'm just like, okay, no more grief stories. I just can't do it. It hits too hard on me in my chest, and it's just like I don't want to be sad all the time. I'm already sad without books. So like, why would I want to keep being sad? I don't want to be sad. I don't want to be in these sad narratives, and also coupled with Hua Su's very intellectual, way of talking, I'm just like, nah, I can't do it.
I think the main thing is that grief has become such a big genre for the book literary
Industry, yeah.
industry, and people buy into that because I guess as a human that you need to compare your sadness with someone else to feel like your life is a little bit better or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, people have that perverse need too. Yeah, definitely.
But the thing that I don't feel like connected to Hua Xu's story is that he talks a lot about his college life. It's almost like a boy narratives. You know, we hang out on the on top of the roof of our dormitory. We smoke, we drink, and I just don't feel that kind of engagement that we had. And just
yeah,
so it just don't feel resonated to it. I mean, the writing.
So you, yeah, I mean, it's undeniable. He's a great writer, just not the kind of writer I. That resonates with me. Yeah. Often when I find these people like Hwasu, who is Taiwanese like me, it reminds me actually my most important identity marker is that I'm a woman. That is the most foundational basis for me when I connect with people. I don't care if you're from another country, like the thing that roots us in a sort of shared experience is the fact that we're women. And I think that's why I connect with Gia Tolentino's writing way more.
Yeah.
Male privilege, right? Yeah. Men have way much more privilege than we do. So, Helen, you listened to this on Audible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he read it probably as well. Yeah.
Was he? Was he a good reader?
Reader, yeah. I think.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So I might do that one day when maybe when I'm 55 and, like, open to grief narratives. So I have been audiobooking two books at the same time, one through my library and one through Audible. And so the first one I want to talk about, and I'll talk about them quickly for two of them, is a book called, it's a memoir called The Country of the Blind. It's by a writer called Andrew Leland. I came across this book thanks to the New York Times top books of the year. One of the editors mentioned it. And she said that after reading this book, it'll change the way you look at sight. I don't think it has. I still don't really think about my, like, it hasn't changed the way I see the world. And it hasn't been as profound as the editor said, but it's still like something I think is absolutely incredible. Andrew Leland has a rare mutation, a rare form of retinal disease. Degenerative retinal disease. He's an Ashkenazi Jew. Also, his wife is Jewish, and apparently it's a higher rate of this kind of mutation found within that cohort of the society. And he started getting blind in his early 20s, and it got progressively worse. Now he's in his middle age. I think he's, I'm not quite sure how old he is, but he is, I think he's like, maybe if I just search my, no, it doesn't say on Google, doesn't say how old he is, but he looks around 50, 45, and he's almost going blind. And it's just, it's a memoir about blindness, about the way in which most of the world don't understand blindness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people just think it's, you're either blind or you're not. Yeah. There's no, like, middle ground, whereas he's like, well, most people who are legally blind actually can have a bit of sight. And the way in which most sighted people don't really understand the nuances of the disability. I think the most fascinating part of this book is the way in, are the parts in which he actually deep dives, the chapters where he deep dives into the technological advances that have been, that have actually, that like the technological advances that we have sighted people and like the rest of the world have benefited from, and the way in which it actually started with disability, like it actually, the technology for like smartphone and AI and all those kind of tech devices that we use, like touch screens and voice activation and all those things that we kind of that Apple kind of brings out every few months. All of them began with blind people and like blind activists pushing for better technology to make their lives easier. And like, for instance, audio descriptions in movies, you know, sometimes, you know, you'll see a movie and they have captions, but not just captions, but audio descriptions. Yeah. Like a lot of these things that we now benefit actually began with blind technology or engineers. Make like designing things. They were like the first innovators to have built these kind of very specific technology that in which sighted people and the rest of the world now benefit. So I think that those chapters were the most fascinating for me. Otherwise, and I also listened to this on Audible, and I think, I don't know if Andrew Leland reads it himself. I think he does. And yeah, it's a really easy read. It's like 5 or 6 hours. So definitely recommend that if you want to learn more about like what it means to be blind and that world.
Yeah.
Kind of, it made me think a lot about my favorite book of all time, which is, I mean, my favorite book of fiction is Tomorrow and Tomorrow, but my favorite book of all time is Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. And that talks about, you know, parents of disabled children. And this, the one chapter that it kept reminding me about was the deaf chapter. So the deaf community and how cochlear implants are, you know, a huge thing, that sign language is a very important part of the deaf community. So that is my recommendation for that, Andrew Leland. And my other audiobook was actually also a kind of memoir, although it wasn't actually a memoir. It was a book about Glossier, you're the fashion brand from America. It's called Glossy, and it's by Marissa Meltzer. And obviously it's about the inside story of Emily Weiss and the way she built her Into the Gloss company from a blog into a multi-billion-dollar beauty empire. Have you heard of Glossier, Helen?
I've heard of Glossier, but I didn't know about this book. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I had never heard of Glossier, and it kind of shook me and made me realize how, in a way, I'm kind of proud, but it made me realize how distant I am from the beauty world, because it seems that everyone knows Glossier. And I think it's just because the fact that I'm just so not interested in beauty, you know, it's
Yeah, it's not something that we invest our time into.
Yeah. I mean, like, I buy beauty products, sure, but I definitely don't spend hours, like, you know, reading, like scrolling through Instagram, looking at the latest fashion or beauty trends. Mm-hmm. But this book is about Emily Weiss and the company that she built when she was 25, I think she started. And It's great. Like, it's a very easy read. It's fascinating. It's interesting. A big dive into the beauty world. Can also equally recommend that.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay. Should we talk about the films that we watched? Let's start with the one that you told me to watch.
Yes, so this
weekend. Yeah, go ahead.
This is, of course, Leave the World Behind, a Netflix film that dropped at the end of November that everyone has been talking about. I thought the first half was incredible and the second half was completely crap. As in, like, the storyline just went nowhere. I thought the ending was so jolting. It had a very clear message, the way it ended, which we'll talk about later. But Leave the World Behind obviously stars Ethan Hawke, Julie Roberts, Mahershala Ali, sort of post-apocalyptic scenario, dropped on Netflix. It kind of has the same tenor as Don't Look Up. So Don't Look Up was about climate change. This one, who knows, it's about like cyber attacks, right? Mm-hmm. And I loved the first half because it was so bone-chillingly frightening, because you just never saw the alien or the monster, which is ultimately what frustrated me in the end, because I wanted to see something. I wanted to see an evil person, but we never got to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the second half of the movie being, for me, really frustratingly not focused, I still absolutely loved this movie for the tension and the suspense that it had.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the movie White Noise, starring Greta Gerwig and Adam Driver last year, which is the movie that my husband
hated.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to, I really can't stand Adam Driver, so I haven't seen it.
So it's like a post-apocalypse vibe, sort of the genre that where a family was having a hard day, trying to get away, but then again, they are still deeply connected digitally. I think there's a large portion of the film that talks about the connection of digital in our human life, where that we, as humans, that we can just never can simply get away, you know, because that's what the what's her name, Amanda, is that the character that Julia Roberts
played? Yeah, the Karen.
Yeah, she's trying to get away, you know, from everything, because at the first, you know, the first 5 minutes, she said that she fucking hates people. Yeah. For me, there's a lot of things that I interpreted. I don't know that you feel the same as well. There was, I feel like the youngest character in the movie, the little girl.
The daughter.
My interpretation of her character is almost as if that it's reflecting the young people, the millennials or the Gen Z, whatever you want to call it, where she is very obsessive about TV sitcoms. You know, we see throughout the movie she's obsessed with Friends, and she's obsessed with being happy. She needs to be happy, whereas survival for her doesn't seem like is an important thing. She is not there to survive, but she's there to seek the satisfaction of emotion. That's why she's obsessed with Friends. She constantly wants to watch Friends, and she wants to know what happened in the end. My interpretation of that she's confused with happiness and lust, like ultimately that she couldn't wait to satisfy that kind of emotion. And that kind of pushes them to make decisions to change. It's not like it's a bad thing, but at the same time, in the movie that you can see that it feels like that her selfishness prevails, that she only looked after herself pretty much.
Yeah, I agree
completely. She escapes from her family just because she wants to
see the end of friends,
you know.
Yep.
And that motivated her to, I don't know, maybe stay alive. I'm not sure whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I feel like that's an interpretation that I myself got from that character. What do you think of that?
You've basically said what my interpretation was, which is that because the movie could have ended at any point, the fact that it ended specifically when Rose puts in the DVD and she starts the annoying Friends intro. Also, I hate Friends. I've got nothing for it. I think people who love Friends are super basic. and the fact that they stopped there, to me, it was like glaringly this is just my interpretation, but I thought that the filmmakers were basically saying the people who survive in the end are the ones who chase their own happiness, or like just doggedly chase their own need to feel good. And so Rose was like, I need to know what happened to Rachel and Ross. And she actually in the end is at least the one who we know for sure survives, because she finds the bunker. We don't know if, like, I asked the people around me who I watched it with, like, do you think that the rest of the family survive? And they were like, yes, they do. And in my head, I was like, no, there's no guarantee of that, because we never see that. So I reckon in the end, because she's the clear guaranteed sole survivor, for me, it was like a very ham-fisted way in which the filmmaker was saying to us, the person who survives apocalypse in the end is the one who's deluded, who's like delusionally driven to see to chase whatever fulfills them. So like Rose is the only one who is like really, really sure about what she wants, which is, you know, from the get-go, she wants to see the end of the last episode of the series. Everyone else were like, they're like not really sure what they want or whatever, but like at least Rose, she knows what she wants and she goes and gets it. And sort of like that was what the filmmakers were trying to say.
I wonder why they choose Friends.
Because it's basic.
I think it's basic, and also it's something that really divides people. You either love it or you hate it, and we are the group that are, you know, we hate Friends, partly because that when we were growing up, whenever the Friends was on TV, our dad kept saying that, oh, it's such a delusional lifestyle.
Really?
Yeah, I remember.
I don't remember.
No one can afford such, you know, apartment. I think that really drew into my mind of this is such a not something that I'll aspire to. It's like everyone's happy, everyone's living in such a luxury, you know, New York apartment. Were they in New York? I don't even know. Anyway,
it's New York, yeah.
Yeah.
Central Park Cafe.
That's right, yeah. And I've actually, I think most of my Asian friends hate Friends because it's contained a lot of racism throughout the whole, you know, I don't know, 10 plus seasons. Racism, unachievable, unreal sort of lifestyle that people just sit around the cafe every day, play music. And there's no real work that's been done, you know? Yeah.
I just find Ross annoying. Like, he's the worst character who's ever been written. David Schwimmer is a wet blanket. I'd like to bring in Billy Stevenson's take on Friends. He said to me recently, this is the TV film critic, Billy Stevenson. Follow him at cinemamusicbooks.com.
Pilot Club.
He said, yeah, the Pilot Club also, yes. So he said this is his theory on Friends. Mm-hmm. And he kind of uses this explanation, puts this explanation alongside Seinfeld. So he said the people who love Friends were the people in high school who were either in the cool group or who wanted to be in the cool group.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like people who love Seinfeld are just the misfits. Or like the people in school who just didn't fit in and were not kind of cardboard copy people who didn't really fit in, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't love either. Like I'm not a huge Seinfeld fan, and I really don't like Friends, and so I don't, you know, really match myself. I don't fit into this equation, but I really like his take on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have seen people who love Friends are a bit just like not my type of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the other characters. I like the character GH and his interaction with his daughter, where they're at the first part of the movie, there's a lot of mystery. I think the suspense comes from the unknown. What is exactly behind this chaos in the world, or in America, and specifically in the movie? He had a one line where GH talked about his work, where he talked about a client of his is not learning their mistakes. You know, I think it's like an investment hedge fund or something like that. Something
mm-hmm.
like that. And then the client loses more and not learning the mistakes that they have done with their investing behaviors. My interpretation of that, it's almost as it was reflecting on how Americans or general human beings does not learn, as if that's like a human nature, like we keep making mistakes or have a certain sort of pattern that is very difficult to change, and that kind of that would lead to miscommunication between us as in the echo chamber of our own community and someone, you know, might be more like Donald Trump. You know, we can never communicate with that kind of people. It's hard. And I think that's probably the misalignment that the movie somehow is trying to talk about. Because the movie pokes fun of conspiracy theories as well. There's a satirical narrative throughout the movie. And also, seeing what we cannot see, but seeing what we can see, but others cannot. There's like a scene. There's a one scene where Julia Roberts picked up her phone and there was notification, and the next moment she's trying to show her husband the notification disappears.
That was a great scene.
Yeah, and also the deer. You know, the animals coming out from
that was annoying.
Yeah.
The deer thing was so fucking annoying. I was like, oh, enough with the deers.
Yeah, it's almost like
so ham-fisted.
Trying to portray like a, you know, our human versus the animal, the natural world.
Yeah, and then that stupid scene where she and the black daughter, Julia Roberts and the daughter, and the other man's daughter were like screaming their head off.
Yeah,
I was like, this is just getting embarrassing.
Yeah, it's like trying to. This is a symbolic moment where it's hard to communicate with another group of people that they don't have the same values or the same concept with you. And it's becoming harder in our current society because we end up trapped into our own echo chamber while others trapped in their own echo chamber as well. That's what I thought about when we can see what we see, but the others don't see it. I think that was something that the film was trying to say. Again, because this is an American film, I just found it so funny that I think it's at the end of the, almost at the end of the film where Kevin Bacon comes out as this, you know, the guy who, the survivalist that tried to protect his own family.
I know what you're about to say, but go on.
Okay. That they start blaming other countries.
Yeah. Wait, but also, did you notice that he made an error with the languages? What? Remember when he was like, oh, this, the pamphlet, the red pamphlets that were printed out, he said that they were printed in Russian and Arabic, and then he said Mandarin?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, that's wrong. It's Chinese, not Mandarin.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, this is how poor that the production team that can.
I know. I was like, did they not have at least one
culture check?
Yeah. I know.
Mandarin is so weird. It's a spoken language. It's not a language.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very foreign.
It's like literally just not one single Chinese person or like Asian could have like
picked them up on purpose.
Mistake.
Or maybe they did it on purpose as in to represent how ignorant that the character is. Yeah, I want to talk about that how they usually will blame other countries, you know, in the movie that they reference Iran, they reference Korea, they reference China. Mm-hmm. So it's always someone else is trying to attack the US. They wouldn't
It's America.
Look at themselves and think about the shit things that they've done. Yeah.
Well, it's America, so yeah.
Okay, so that's my take on Leave the World Behind. Much and makes you think of a lot of things. Before we go, I want to talk about something that's more lighthearted. Is a small trend that is happening on Instagram. I don't think it's like a massive trend. It's not something that's trending, but I thought it was really fun seeing a couple of the Instagrammers that I follow. There were three. One's Indian, the other one, actually, the other two are like mixed race Instagrammers, and they did this short clips about, we are something something, and therefore something something. And one of the mixed Blasian siblings, I just want to show, I don't know if I can show it to you, if I can share the screen.
We love this guy.
Yeah, I love this guy, Brandon.
So he's half Blasian. What is he half what?
We're Blasian. Both our parents beat us.
We're Blasian.
Black don't crack, Asian don't race.
We're Blasian.
My nigga.
What?
My nigga.
Blasian.
Yeah, so there's another one. This one.
Question our identity.
Are you more black or Asian? We're mixed kids. People call us exotic.
We're Mexicans. We don't know our respective languages.
Oh, 你叫我没学好。We're
Mexicans.
We're
Mexicans.
Oh, so funny, okay? And yeah, so that's pretty funny. And I thought about if I do one as we're Taiwanese, what would you say?
Oh, you know, that's so hard because I don't know what Taiwan. The only thing I think about is the line in Joyride where the woman's like, Taiwanese is like weird but cute. Do you remember?
It's at the airport.
I think we're like very independent.
Mm-hmm.
Like as in we're always actively like, oh, we're not part of China.
Yes.
Right? That's probably
the real Taiwanese.
One of the first things I think about.
Yeah,
I think we're. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what makes. Yeah, what Taiwanese is like. I mean, I guess apart from Chinese, you know.
I would say that we're Taiwanese. We carry our iconic Da Tong rice cookers wherever we go. The
iconic.
Yeah, the iconic one. And I'll say that we're Taiwanese, we speak at least one of the dialect, like we're multilingual. We're Taiwanese, we have this love-hate relationship with our previous colonizers. Like we have
Japan.
Colonized by Japan.
Yeah.
Kind of occupied by US, but it's, I don't think a lot of Taiwanese hate Japan. We're Taiwanese, our national drink is bubble tea. That's a bit simple, that's very basic. We're Taiwanese, I'll say the convenience store is just like our kitchen.
Yeah.
It's like a mandatory daily exercise of going to like a 7-Eleven or a Family Mart.
Yeah, I can't, I think because I'm not around a lot of Taiwanese people and I don't know like the, I haven't lived there extensively as an adult. I wouldn't know. And I'm also not online a lot. So I don't know what like distinctly makes us who we are. Like I think I can, I'm better equipped at saying we're Australian because
what about Australia?
We love beer more than water. We're obsessed with the beach. We get skin cancer. We get skin cancer. We're all bogans.
Yeah. I agree with the last one. We're all bogans.
Yeah. We love sport more than books.
I do also wonder that whether or not that is kind of like a stereotyping group of people. But then
of course.
Found it's really fun.
But also they're true. You know, the Asian one you wrote, you put on at the end, the we're Asian because, and the two girls, like all of that was true for us.
Yeah, they're all facts.
Maybe not the 20 shoes and all that is all true. And the children complimenting, no compliments, we don't hug and all that. That's all true. The newspaper, we don't do it at home, but I know that when we go back to Taiwan, our family does it. Like I know our relatives do that. Put newspaper on top of the dining table. Yeah.
It's like a table cloth.
Remember when we went to town that year, my dad's parents. When we had sat down for a meal, our tablecloths, table mats, our dining mats, like the individual ones in front, were like brochures, just like.
I think even mum
did this, like as in like catalog brochures from the supermarket.
Yeah. And when we were
going laid that out. Yeah.
Our dad runs a travel agent. So he.
Oh, yeah. We used those brochures. Yeah. I still remember that.
Catalogs. And mom puts them as into like little paper boxes.
Yeah.
As rubbish bins. Fish bones.
But also, I remember like ripping apart those brochures and putting them down as table mats.
Yeah.
Placemats.
Yeah. We recycled.
That's what I was looking for.
Far before anyone else.
That's really comforting. I might remember to do that for our Christmas party when you guys come over. I'll just have to pop over to Flight Center to get those brochures.
When we look at those beautiful pictures of other cities and we dream that we want to travel there.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality of the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week and this year, and we'll chat to you next year.
Stay safe. Have a good summer, everybody, or winter.